Is there something bothering your car? Are you hearing a wobble or a whine where there should be a hum? Our next guest has heard many of these over the years. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive and our partner in a monthly segment we call The Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you are the squeaky wheel. Give us a call or email to talk about automotive issues you've had or are currently having. This month, we're focusing on those funny clicks and clunks or excessive bounciness in your car. Suspension and steering, the focus this month. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. What is often, Zach, then the first thing that's going to go, either in suspension or steering, and what are the obvious sounds or signs of that failure?
Well, a lot of the time, shocks and struts wear out first. They're generally good for somewhere around 50,000 miles, and they slowly, over time, wear out. And so oftentimes the feedback we get after replacing a customer's shocks or struts is, wow, I didn't know how bad it was until I got them replaced.
Uh-huh.
Because the transgression is slow over time. And once they become replaced, the car feels a lot more, when cornering or when going over irregular road surfaces, the car feels much more stable. And those bumps don't cause the cabin area to shift more. You know, it feels like you're driving a boat sometimes when your shocks or struts are really worn out, because the cabin area moves and sways, and the jounce is a term we use, the how many times it goes up and down after you hit a speed bump.
Oh, so it should go ba-boom, ba-boom, and then settle back down. But
settle,
if it goes,
yep.
That's the...
Well, if it bounces up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down, but the bounce slowly fizzles out to nothing, that's a sign that your shocks or struts are worn out. They should kind of react to the bump and then immediately stabilize.
I think people have gotten used to the idea of shock absorbers. I mean, it's that piston-y looking thing that provides some cushioning to the ride. So what are the struts, though? Are those the other component that's actually keeping things attached to the body?
Yeah, shocks are not really used on passenger cars anymore. They're called McPherson struts, mm-hmm. and they serve the same purpose, but shock absorbers are used on truck applications, and a lot of trucks are using McPherson struts now as well. Heavy-duty trucks, though, still use shocks. And so the McPherson strut, which would apply to most passenger cars, it's comprised of a coil spring, and inside the coil spring is a shock absorber, and so it's a dual setup.
But you used to have a separate coil spring and a shock absorber. Right now it's one thing together?
Well, yeah, or you'd have some other type of suspension with a shock absorber, not necessarily a coil spring. So with pickup trucks, you know, they have leaf springs in the back, and those hold the weight of the vehicle, and then the shock absorber part really smooths and dampens the irregularities that the car experiences, so speed bumps or potholes or just little dimples in the road or any irregularities. And so the leaf spring or the other type of suspension component is, again, it's going to support the weight of the vehicle. And then when the car hits a bump, you know, if you didn't have the shock, the car would bounce up and down excessively. And the shock is meant to kind of slow that down and dampen those forces from affecting the people inside the cabin.
The old test used to be, and I don't know if this was even a good test back then, but when you had shock absorbers, to go to the corner of the car, usually the front corner.
This is the jounce.
This is the jounce. Okay,
yeah.
So give it a good hard shove downward, and if it bounces down and then back up and stops, your shocks are pretty good. If it bounces down and kind of wobbles for a while before it settles in.
Exactly.
That's the
jounce. Yep. And so that's one good test as far as just wear and tear. There's other things that can fail with, especially with the McPherson struts. They have on the front of the vehicle, those struts, because of the cars are front-wheel drive, they have to be able to turn with the wheel. And so at the top of the McPherson strut, you have a bearing assembly. And there's also rubber bushings inside that assembly as well. So between all of those components, you can have a variety of weird noises that come from a failing strut assembly. And so some noises are, you know, when you go over I always use the speed bump, but again, we could talk about Middle Clay Street as having one of the most irregular road surfaces in town. If you're driving down Middle Clay Street
yeah.
and you're hearing this clattering noise, that could be coming from a missing rubber grommet or bushing from a McPherson strut assembly or a failing upper bearing, because those, and this goes to back to how difficult it can be to try and isolate where the noise is coming from, because you could get a similar rattle noise from three or four different suspension components, and when they fail, they all sound the same. So it really has to fall on the technician and the person's experience, the level of experience and their ability to problem solve to, you know, try and accurately figure out what is exactly making that funny rattling noise.
Zach Edwards from Ashland Automotive is back for this month's edition of The Squeaky Wheel. We're focusing on suspension and steering, but if you've got another issue you'd like to deal with your car, give us a call or send an email, 800-838-3760, to get in by phone. Send the emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Is there a particular year when after which it's mostly McPherson struts?
There was, yeah. It was quite a while ago. Cars went to the McPherson strut. I don't even know, probably in the early 90s.
Is there any difference in the cost of repairs for a McPherson strut versus just getting shock absorbers replaced?
Yeah, shock absorbers are much easier to replace labor-wise. Mm-hmm. The McPherson strut assembly to be replaced, remember, there's a shock inside of a compressed coil spring, and it's all one big assembly. So when you have those replaced, the technician's going to pull out the assembly and then has to put the assembly inside of a special spring compressor tool, which these springs, if you can imagine, you know, the diameter of the steel, it's like tempered steel, and it's probably 3/4 inch to 1 1/4 inches, depending on the size of the vehicle.
They could shoot a person across a room if handled barely.
It would kill a person. If it came loose and hit somebody, it would be a tragedy for sure. Mm-hmm. So the tool required to be able to squeeze this spring down and hold it in place while the technician removes the center cartridge out of it, that's a pretty, you know, there's a variety of tools, but really good, safe and efficient tools are pretty expensive. And so the labor, back to the cost of that, the labor is more to replace struts than it is to just replace shocks, because the shock is generally just two bolts, and you can remove that shock absorber and then put the new one in. Now, the problem with replacing shocks is the bolts oftentimes break because they're rusted or completely seized and they haven't been touched in 50 or 100,000 miles. And so that's kind of one of the obstacles we run into when replacing a set of shocks. But assuming everything disassembles okay, it's a pretty basic job. But struts are much more difficult.
Is the test the same for shocks or for struts to give the jounce?
Yeah, but when it's just a shock absorber setup, you know, you have to consider the leaf springs could be part of the excessive jouncing as well. And so, again, the technician's just going to have to, you know, do a little bit more sleuthing to try and figure out. Maybe it's a combination of both.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, shocks and struts can leak, and that's always a good sign. If you see like an oily film around the cartridge of the shock assembly or the strut, that's an indicator that the seal is beginning to fail or has completely failed. And that, you know, basically these shocks and struts, the strut cartridges, which is basically a shock but inside of the coil spring, they're filled with a hydraulic fluid and gas charge, and that's meant to be contained. And eventually that seal fails, and then the fluid leaks out, and then dust clings to that fluid. And so you'll see a big buildup of dust and gooey stuff. And then you know that unit is on its way out or is completely failed.
Zach Edwards, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange for The Squeaky Wheel, as we talk about shocks and struts and steering and suspension in this month's edition of The Squeaky Wheel. You're welcome to join us with your automotive puzzlers, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about the difficulty in front-wheel drive cars, and I've often wondered about that how those transmissions work, but obviously it gets fairly complicated both between suspension and steering, for that matter, too, I would think, because you have your powered wheels are actually having to turn at the same time.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on up there, and when they start to make clonks and clatters and those types of noises, there's just so many different things that could be causing that, and as much as we hate to say it, sometimes with all the best investigative work and all the experience, it does come down to, in the worst case scenario, is it just a trial and error. Like, we have to replace this part and see what happens. We never want that, you know, to be the case, but sometimes in the worst cases, we just have to replace a part. And so I was just talking the other day, there's been some really problematic cars in the past, and Honda Elements, mm-hmm. and CRVs are some of the we've struggled the most with some of those. They have some strange vibration and rattling problems that we've struggled with in the past. And at one point we had replaced a solid axle on this Honda Element because the axle contained a bearing assembly as well, and the only way to replace that bearing was to buy the whole axle, and it didn't fix the problem, so we took it back out and put the old one back in. And
wow.
And I just sold that part the other day on eBay as gently used, and I was so relieved to get rid of it because it was very expensive, and you know, we didn't want to charge the customer for it, so we just put it back on the shelf and thought maybe we'd sell it sometime, and 5 years had gone by. But sometimes it's just trial and error. It's just really hard to figure out what is causing these problems.
We have a couple of questions here for you. Michael in Medford, maybe it doesn't say, wants to know if you could talk a little bit about piston slap. He says, we have an 18-year-old Subaru that seems to have developed this condition.
Piston slap, that has nothing to do with
no, it doesn't.
Steering and suspension, but I'm happy to talk about it. So piston slap is when, you know, you have a piston and a cylinder, and it's supposed to be a real tight fit inside the cylinder.
We're talking thousandths of an inch, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's the precision is just amazing in these machines, or maybe I think it's amazing. But so the piston is connected to a connecting rod by means of a wrist pin. And what happens is, as cars wear out, that piston can kind of slap around inside the cylinder, and the wrist pin normally has a pretty tight fit. It's a pressed to connect the, and this is really hard to describe on the radio, but to connect the piston to the connecting rod, there's basically a pressed in dowel that allows the piston to move side to side a little bit.
Well, like a wrist, I mean, so that the piston can go up and down, and the crank can move at a slightly different angle.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's a great example of how the wrist moves up and down. But it should be a pretty tight fit. And when that gets worn out, it can become really sloppy. And then as the piston is moving up and down and it's connected to the connecting rod, it can slap around, and it makes kind of it makes a very unique noise. And it's eventually, you know,
is the wrist pin going to fail and wear through? And
well, eventually what can happen is that the cylinder can become scored from the piston's irregular movement inside the cylinder. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the design of the cylinder is such that it's supposed to have just a glaze of oil in there, because these parts are moving so rapidly and basically touching each other. You know, like we said, thousands of an inch of clearance. So there has to be a little layer of oil in there. And if the walls of the cylinder become scored, then the oil does not sit on the walls of the cylinder. You know, the inside of the cylinder has been what's called honed with crosshatch pattern, and that crosshatch pattern inside the cylinder is meant to hold this thin film of oil there. And as the piston goes up and down, it's lubricated, and if the cylinder walls get scorched or scored, I should say, then that thin film of oil doesn't sit in there as it's designed to do, and that's going to eventually lead to catastrophic failure of something inside the cylinder.
I have had lawnmowers where something failed, and the piston actually broke off the end of the crank and shot through the side of the mower. Does that happen with cars?
Yeah, it does. That's very catastrophic. We're doing a Subaru engine right now on one of the shop cars, and you know, we knew it needed an engine, but we were a little bit slow in February, so we disassembled this engine to see exactly what happened. And I think the number four piston, the connecting rod bearing, got completely damaged and banged up and worn out, and that caused that piston to the wrist pin seized up, and then of course the force of the engine smashed that piston up through into the cylinder wall, and the cylinder did not break. Of course, the cylinder is casted and it's very heavy duty, but what happened is the connecting rod broke, which is, you know, caused everything to just stop immediately.
Yeah.
And so that was a pretty catastrophic failure. But in other applications, yeah, the connecting rod can come right through the side of the engine block, and then oil dumps out all over the ground, and you're done driving for
that's
for
it
quite
for that
a while.
Engine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Zach Edwards is here with the Squeaky Wheel, 800-838-3760. With your car issues, emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Lamar in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thanks. I have another off-topic question. I camp out at various RV parks in the Cascades during the summer, and I've had problems with rodents chewing the wiring under the hood, and more lately, one of the radiator hoses. You got any tips or devices that might deter them?
Wow, that's a good one. Thanks for that, Lamar. Not slather bacon fat on your engine parts would be one thing, I think.
Yeah, I think we just posted a photo on our Facebook page the other day of a rodent that got caught in a timing belt assembly and met its end that way. We found a new product that we're selling where basically we hose down the entire engine compartment with this anti-rodent solution. It's supposed to really drive them away, and we've seen good results thus far. There's a lot of really good positive reviews about this product. I forget the name of it right now, but I'm sure there's similar products out there. Another, you know, a lot of people have this problem at their house, and what we encourage them to do is not always park in the same spot, kind of move around, because these rodents are creatures of habit. But there's a good chance, Lamar, that your rodents are traveling with you.
So they're not coming from the Cascades.
Well, they might have come one day and never left. So they'll hide in cavities under your hood or in your air filter housing or other places, and they'll just go everywhere with you. And so sometimes a good thing to do is just set out the old traps, the slap traps, under the hood. You know, that's kind of a task. You got to figure out where they travel around, and then finding a good flat spot to set a trap can be difficult. But in a big motorhome, it might be easier because you've got more space. But if you can trap a couple under the hood, you might find that you can get rid of them. And the other thing is there's supposedly peppermint oil. They really dislike peppermint oil. That's more of a natural remedy. Mm-hmm. We've tried that, and some people have reported it successful. Other people have said it didn't work.
I was going to ask you about the anti-rodent solution, how toxic that might be.
It's environmentally friendly. The one we're using is, you know, like I said, there's probably a couple different ones on the market, but the one we're using is pretty okay for the environment. But the peppermint oil you put on cotton balls or something like that, you just soak it. And that's peppermint oil is actually pretty expensive, so it's not a cheap
not a cheap fix, but it's certainly a nice-smelling one for humans.
Yeah, yeah.
Got that going on.
Good luck, Lamar.
Yeah, thanks for that, Lamar. John and Eugene writes in about his 2003 Forester, 85,000 miles and 8 years since the last timing belt replacement. A question mark now? It's not 100,000, but it has been many years. Water pump, too. P.S., I really liked your segment about fixing the old vehicle from an environmental cost perspective.
Hey, thanks. An 03 Forester with 85,000... And it's, 8 years since?
Yeah, the last time he built replacement.
He did it in 2010. So it's on that car, it's every 105,000 miles or every 10 years, whichever comes first. So I'd say you're coming up soon, but not due yet. And hopefully at your last interval, when you changed it in 2010, they did all of the rollers and the idler bearings and any type of rolling assembly, that particular belt winds and weaves its way through three or four rollers and tensioners. And so you're not only concerned about the belt failing, but you're also concerned about any of those roller assemblies that have a sealed bearing inside of them. If any of them fail, that's going to cause the belt to overheat and rip and tear in half. And so if you're hearing any strange whirring or, it's usually a whirring type of bearing noise when the car is started first thing in the morning, that's something that might kind of tip you off that you've got an idler or a bearing failing. But if the job was done in its entirety 8 years ago, then you should be fine for another 20,000 miles or 2 years.
Oh, well, now it sounds like we're talking about my car, because if it sounds a little groany in the morning, that might be something like that?
Yeah, the whirring noise, I just want to spell it whirr. So like
excellent.
It'd be like you'd kind of hear it's a rotational noise, and it just sounds rough. It sounds like something is old. And that can, there's a lot of moving parts, and there's also drive belts that use the same type of bearing components and tensioners that keep the belt tight. So it might not be your timing belt components that are making that noise. The way to tell, of course, is to take off the drive belts, your power steering belt, your alternator belt, your air conditioning belt, and then start the car. And if you still hear the noise, then you know it's inside the timing belt assembly.
Ah, so if all the other belts are off and you run the car, not for long, obviously. But
right, yeah, it's okay to start the car for a very brief amount of time and just for diagnostic purposes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Interesting way to look at things, but always some great stuff to talk about. There's just so much going on under the hood and under the car.
Yeah. Some good questions.
All right. Zach Edwards, our guest every month for something called the Squeaky Wheel. He is the proprietor of Ashland Automotive, and I want to thank him for joining us once again.
Thanks, Jeffrey.